Welcome to the Bitcoin Game number 19, the Mega Interview episode. I'm Rob Mitchell. In today's episode, you'll hear 17, yes, 17 never-before-heard interviews from the Texas Bitcoin Conference. I interviewed people ranging from Dr. Robert Murphy and Eric Voorhees to LTB podcaster John Bush and the network's newest podcaster, John Ferguson. If you like hearing about mining equipment, crypto art, the New York Bitcoin Center, Tether, Mycelium, crypto charities, or Infinity algorithms, you've tuned into the right episode, the Mega Interview episode. Let's kick off the Mega Interview episode with Nick Spanos from the New York Bitcoin Center. So I always see pictures of the Bitcoin Center in New York, and it just looks so amazing and high-tech. Is that so that's where you work out of?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm the founder.
You are the founder. Wow. Yeah.
We named it a Bitcoin Center. We had as a sort of as an event space where I had to convince them to convert it to Bitcoin Center, yeah.
Oh, well, it's always just the visual of that. It always looks so impressive to me. That,
it costs a lot of money.
I bet. Yeah. Well, I think it's
about $37,500 a month rent.
Wow.
That's where you got to pay to be next door to the stock exchange.
How do you pay those bills?
It's challenging.
I bet. Well, that's
especially we've had a lot of water problems. There's a pool on top of us, and it kind of like rains on us every few days.
Oh man. You rent out this space, or how do you possibly pay that bill?
Yeah, yeah, we have sponsors and stuff. I mean, we'd like more sponsors, of course.
Okay.
If anyone's out there, you know, you come, you ring the bell, you get a lot of press. We have a whole press team, all the news press from next door, from the stock market, comes across if it's great. And
how do people reach out to you if they wanted to get involved or donate or sponsor?
They can go to the website. NYCBitcoinCenter.com.
Okay, and on your table you have some type of a Bitcoin ATM or...
Yeah, that's the chassis is from another company, and inside is the cash to BTC software.
Okay, so it's running. A one-way machine.
That one's one way. We have two ways. I mean, the incubator is Blockchain Technologies Corp.
Uh-huh.
And there are about nine companies that are being incubated. And we hope within 6 weeks that we'll be public. We have a company that we purchased that's a public company. Or no, it's purchasing us. I'm not sure. You got to talk to the lawyers. But okay. There's a public company that we're converting to Blockchain Technologies Corp. And we have a bunch of blockchain products. Mm-hmm. Cryptos.com. Bitcoinoption.com, and a bunch more. SlideChain, the Bitcoin 2.0.
Hear mostly just trying to get the word out about all these projects? Or what's your main reason for having this booth here today?
I wasn't even going to be in Texas. I was going to be somewhere else, but I don't know. We all got the bright idea to come down here a day ago, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay. Last minute. Huh?
So we whipped this up. Everyone else is en route at the airlines.
Uh-huh.
I came in last night, and we'll see what happens.
Well, thanks for talking to me. It's good to meet
Thank
you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'll give you a
come
call.
On down. Come on down to Bitcoin Center.
Oh, yeah. We'll see. I haven't been to New York for
quite a while. I'm buying the drinks.
All right.
Free drinks, free food.
I don't want you to run short when it comes to having to pay the next month's lease payment. So that's all right. I'll buy you a drink. All right. Thanks for talking.
Take care.
I'm going to look at your name tag so I get your name right. It's Elizabeth Groth.
Elizabeth Grote Müller.
Okay. I would never have gotten that right.
Yeah, sorry.
And you came from... Copenhagen?
Yeah, I came from Copenhagen, Denmark.
Okay, well, I caught your speech today. Is this your first Bitcoin conference that you've spoken at?
Or? It is officially my first Bitcoin conference spoken at. It's been really great because the community is really ambitious and forward-minded, and I think it's really awesome to come here and speak.
You gave a very compelling speech. And
thank you. It's important stuff to address.
Yeah, well, it's very easy, I think, to forget about how hard the world is for so many people on the planet.
Right.
And I think sometimes it's hard to go about your own lives trying to think of everyone's pain. I know I have, you know,
yeah.
I can, you know, try to stay cognizant of that, and then I'm fairly depressed when
yeah.
I am. It's,
yeah.
It's kind of a tough thing, so.
Yeah, I totally understand, but it's like I can't think about any of that because I'm not doing it for me. I'm not even doing it for our new site. I'm doing that for them who needs help.
So you said you started this project basically 7 years ago?
Yeah. My mom, she, Annette Rotemilla, she is the founder, and she got the idea in JFK Airport 7 years ago. And it was just, she was kind of like struck by lightning, and she got the idea. It was amazing.
Well, it's wonderful. It seems like a very giving project.
Yeah, definitely.
And so just to kind of review it, it's basically a peer-to-peer way.
It's a global platform that is peer-to-peer charity. So we bridge needs and potentials. So it's like you can give directly to someone who's in need, and you know, pretty friction-free if we use Bitcoin.
And is the system actually up and running right now?
It is up and running right now. We are just launching today, so it's really exciting.
So I see on your thing, it's commoncollection.com.
Yes, it is.
So someone can go there and basically just choose to support a specific person or cause?
A specific person who is representing a specific person, basically. Like I was talking about a Mr. Kasim, who's a cancer patient. He is listed as an urgent case. So people can right now go in and donate to that patient, so he doesn't need to choose between paying for children's tuition or having chemotherapy shots.
Yeah, so, it's what a horrible situation.
It is really a horrible situation, yeah.
So is it always a specific gift? Could you just say, hey, I want this to go divided among all your people, or it's always a specific person?
Not at all. Because we are a platform and we're not an NGO, I think we have an advantage because we, We don't set any limits to how creative people can be using Common Collection. We give people the liberty to do like what they want, and because it's self-regulated in a way, because we have a review system, then people can get more notice and mm-hmm. you know.
So, in your presentation, you had some pictures, and you were actually in India.
Yeah.
Was that purely for this cause?
It was, yes, and it was very interesting because we have some technical people that we are working with to create this site, and we wanted to find our first local networkers and sort of see what kind of market we were dealing with in India. So that was really interesting, and it was very educating for me to get to these parts of India and see what's really going on. Yeah.
Interesting. So are you also looking for like major donations from companies or philanthropists?
Sorry, what?
Are you looking for like, bigger donations? I know it's kind of a peer-to-peer level, but
yeah.
Also...
I mean, we are always happy to get sponsors, and we have a special sponsorship program that people could get involved with. But because we're not an NGO, we are not like... Yeah, we will use every... funds that we get to Common Collection to improve our site.
Okay, and what is NGO?
NGO, that's a non-governmental organization.
Oh, because you are a non-gov...
We are not one.
You're not a non-governmental.
Yes. We're so, not an organization at all. We are only a platform.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, wait, you're not governmental.
Yeah,
it's
like not, you know.
It's great what you're doing. I think it's very admirable that you're dedicating your time and your life to helping others. So I hope you're really successful in helping the world.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
I'm here with Troy Fierno of CryptoArt. And I've definitely seen your art and recently saw Charlie Lee tweet. He seemed excited to see your Litecoin art, I guess, and your Bitcoin art. And it's not just art. It has a little window where you can see a public key. And is it kind of sealed inside as the private key?
Yeah, there's a private key attached to the back, and it's under a security sticker. You can remove that security sticker and retrieve that private key to to sweep the Bitcoin off the art piece, and you could do that without damaging the art piece. So if you want it to be trustless, you don't trust me with the private keys, you could exchange that private key and exchange the public key, which is the QR code on the front. You can do all that without damaging the art print.
And I am going to say it's both beautiful art and it looks like it's really well done. Do you have a background with fine art pieces?
I own fine-art.com, so I've had 20 years of retailing fine art. This is my first venture into publishing art. So I did a lot, as much research as I can, and I actually brought the publishing in-house and really took my time on the types of paper that I chose. The artist, obviously, that's the biggest decision. You're trying to get art that is going to resonate inside the community, convey some type of message, add to the narrative, and then just now I'm trying to expand the artists. I have three artists now. I also have a studio that did some work. Two Dots out in France did some work, and they're known for doing their work on Assassin's Creed and Far Cry. So we have some pretty big artists that are starting to contribute to crypto art as well.
What made you decide to do this?
Well, I was backing up my Bitcoin on private keys and just making paper wallets and having a kind of some creative sense of things. I wanted to make it a little more visually enjoyable and enjoy my Bitcoin in physical form because I was just stashing them away. And so I thought there's got to be some way to merge this cold storage process with fine art. So the result is kind of an interesting, almost leveraged investment, because you have your art piece that could appreciate in value, and then you have your cryptocurrency that could appreciate in value. So it becomes this mixture of art, technology, and money, and some physical Bitcoin product.
So you also have this South by Southwest version, and It says 5K bits on it. What's this deal?
Right. This is, so South by actually invited us to set up a pop-up gallery inside the trade show. And that did really, really well. And as a thank you to commemorate the event, that's where we went out to Two Dot Studio and commissioned this piece. And this is what they came up with.
Okay, so you've got Litecoin, Bitcoin, Peercoin. I see you got a Dogecoin.
There is a Dogecoin. Yeah, we'll have a Darkcoin coming out. Although I just heard they changed the name to Dashcoin a few days ago.
Right.
So that presents a small problem, but
well, maybe just the enthusiasts will still and you were telling me you produce all these private keys using an offline computer, but in case someone doesn't want to trust you, I guess that's why you could put your own.
Right. The idea is, yes, definitely, if you're going to store more than $100 or $50, whatever, you absolutely want to put your own private keys in there, and might even want to make a copy of that, just depending on how risk averse you are.
Well, they are very cool. It's neat to see something a little different, and the art side represented here at this Bitcoin conference. And you were saying you really sold quite a few of these at South by Southwest.
Yeah, we did. We made more than 100 new Bitcoin owners at South by Southwest, which was nice.
So you're saying 100 people who didn't own Bitcoin before?
At least 100 people. So what we do is, if you buy the art print and you tweet us, so I'll tip you some Bitcoin and we'll put it on the art piece. So it's an exciting for people that have heard about Bitcoin, but just haven't taken the initiative to go out and set up an account and,
Great. So you're really helping spread Bitcoin adoption.
I'm trying.
Well,
thank you.
You're not trying. You're doing. You're achieving. Well, that's great. All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to me. And so they go to cryptoart.com?
Cryptoart.com. That's right.
And what was the other website you had said?
Fine-art.com. Yes.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Were you with Troy for Crypto Art not too long ago?
Yeah, you took a picture of us, that's right.
Yes, because I do his social media.
Walking up there is Micah Winkelspecht from Gem.
Oh, right on.
And I feel like I ripped him off, basically.
Oh, no.
Because I got a hotel room mm-hmm. at what I thought was the Hyatt that was right next to the venue.
Yeah.
And I thought it had two rooms, and we're both in Venice.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, if you don't have a room yet, I've got a nice room that's next to the venue
okay.
and has two rooms. And, well, it turns out there are two Hyatts. And the Hyatt I'm at, it's not far, but it's you know, a 10-minute walk.
Mm-hmm.
And then I misread a double room. I thought that meant two rooms, but no, they just call it a double room.
That has two beds,
and
but
so
not two rooms.
I hope Micah's not feeling really disappointed. I haven't talked to him since finding out that we weren't right next door to the venue. But
Austin's a pretty cool city.
So Kimberly Morgan, I feel like, yes, I know your name, but why do I know your name?
You probably know my name. I am an executive board member of the Texas Coin Initiative.
Okay.
And I also do PR and social media for Crypto Art, Coin Vault ATM, also the Texas Coin Initiative, and
Coin Vault. Talking to the Coin Vault, Sheldon, is that
Sheldon,
it?
Yes.
Yep, I talked to him last night.
Yep. And Troy, I saw you talking to Troy with Crypto Art.
Do you have a non-Bitcoin day job? Are you full Bitcoin stuff all the time?
Not yet. My day job is I'm an executive secretary.
Uh-huh.
And then my other job is social media and PR. And that's what I'd really like to be doing, because that's really where my heart is. And so that's my goal, is for the next year to have that become more of what I do, because especially in the Bitcoin space, that I've noticed is there's so many entrepreneurs that need somebody to kind of help them with social media and PR. And they need, you know, it's good to have some one person designated to kind of do that. And that's what I do. That's where my heart is. And how many companies now? Like 5 to 7 companies now I'm doing social media and PR for. And as it keeps growing, that's going to be my full-time job.
Mm-hmm. And you're here in Austin, right?
I'm actually from Houston.
Houston.
I'm a Houstonian.
Okay. I don't know geography well enough. How far is Houston from Austin?
It's about 3 hours.
Oh, not too bad.
I think we're about 3 hours east of here. So it's not too far.
And what got you into Bitcoin?
A colleague. I was one of those people that learned from somebody else. A colleague of mine is very into Bitcoin. He's actually treasurer of the Texas Coin Initiative, and he was very into it, and he encouraged me to open my first wallet, and he gave me my first bits. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. That was really simple. I just kind of started going from there.
Can you tell me what the Texas Coin Initiative is?
The Texas Coin Initiative is a nonprofit, and we focus on merchant adoption and, you know, education, consumer education, merchant adoption, and education just in general, of exposing more people to cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, and helping them understand what it is, why we believe it's a good idea, and, you know, because there's a lot of misconceptions out there, especially in the press. The press like to talk about the negative, especially mainstream press talks about the negative things that are happening. And so we're trying to show people, no, there's actually some really good things coming out of Bitcoin. And it's not just Bitcoin, but the technology behind it, the blockchain. And it's been really good. It's really interesting. People walk in with no idea, absolutely no idea. They've heard of it, and they're kind of curious, but they don't understand it. And so what we do is we help them understand it a bit more.
And when did this start for you?
The Texas Coin Initiative started right after last year's conference. We got really hyped, and we were like, you know, we can do something like this. We can do something in Houston. What can we do in Houston? And so that's kind of what we decided, was just kind of to dive into this nonprofit aspect of it, and you know, just educate, because Houston's the fourth largest city in the U.S. So there's a lot of people in Houston, and there's just a lot of opportunity. Like I was telling you before we mic'd up, I was on the Women in Bitcoin panel.
Oh, yes.
And
I'm sorry I missed that one.
Yeah, no, it was good, because we had several different people.
I see Catherine over
here.
Yes,
Catherine was
the
one moderating. Hi! And I think it went really well, and the feedback I got was really good, because we each had kind of a different point of view with, you know, this women in Bitcoin, and bringing women into the space, and just our experiences. And so the general consensus is, yes, there should be more women in the space, because, you know, in my opinion, diversity can be good. But how to do that, how to go about it is, you know, it's kind of interesting, because there's different ways you can do that.
And I wonder how it compares to tech in general. Do you have any idea?
I think tech in general is... it's similar, but it can also be different, because you don't have to have a tech background to be in the space. Like, I don't have a tech background. My background is, like I said, an executive secretary and social media and PR. So I don't have a tech background. And I think, you know, women in tech, you kind of have, there's this, you know, you have to do technology stuff. But with Bitcoin and the blockchain technology, you don't really have to have that.
Well, thanks so much, Kimberly. Where should people go to find out more about what you're working on?
Yes, you can find our website's texascoininitiative.com.
Do you have a personal website or social media ID you want to promote?
I'm mainly on Twitter. Bitcoin star Kim, spelled K-Y-M.
Bitcoin star Kim, okay.
Yeah, so that's where you can find me. I'm tweeting all the latest and greatest on Bitcoin.
Great.
Definitely.
Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, we'll see you around the rest of the conference.
I'll be here. All right, thank you.
Bye. I'm excited to be here with Robert Murphy. Should I say Dr. Robert Murphy? I guess
if you want to be formal.
This is something different for me. I mean, I grew up very liberal and didn't think much about libertarian values and just have become much more exposed and understanding as I got into Bitcoin. And I guess one of the biggest things that, you know, I've come to learn is a lot of people, I think a lot of liberals are just like, oh, people want guns and self-interest and things like that. And it's been interesting to me to see how many are just like against these expensive, horrible wars and things like that. I think there's actually a lot of common ground. And I guess I'm just curious what you have to say to kind of tell the other half, liberals, more to understand where you're coming from.
Well, sure thing. And you're right. I do know there are certain stereotypes, and there are some people who are attracted to a very small government, leave me alone mindset, because they're very individualistic and narcissistic. And so someone who's more compassionate and worried about the poor or whatever would be turned off by that individual. But I would say the broader philosophy of individual liberty and being very skeptical of the people running, you know, the nation state, that is a very healthy attitude. I mean, the standard sort of progressive liberal mantra is, you know, question authority. And so, you know, that in the spirit of that, and let me put it this way, if you didn't like George W. Bush, do you really want him controlling your money? And if you realize, well, no, I don't. Do you want them to be able to bail out big bankers? They can do that if they have the Federal Reserve System and control the nation's banks and money. The virtue of Bitcoin in that dimension is take it away from you. You wouldn't want the government to be in charge of science or the newspapers. That's a very scary possibility, because they might abuse that power. By the same token, you don't want the politicians to have their hands in the money itself. Keep that away from them, and don't have like any one group at all controlling it. That's the beauty of Bitcoin, is no one group is in charge of the money.
What is your economics work?
Well, I used to be a college professor. I write a lot of books sort of explaining complex economics matters to the layperson. Most of my work lately has just been writing for various outlets, talking about government or Federal Reserve policies, try to explain to the layperson. As far as Bitcoin, what I've been trying to do is diffuse objections to it that are coming, you know, from a sort of economic standpoint.
Sure. And before I got into Bitcoin, I was one of the people who defended the Fed in a way. It was like, well, hey, it's better than being in the hands of the government, literally, that they're supposed to be independent and just trying to, I guess, keep things afloat, basically. I mean, what are their mandates? Is it controlling inflation and...
Well, yeah, officially the Fed has what's called a dual mandate, where they're supposed to maintain employment and price stability, okay? And you're right. I mean, the way it's presented is that, oh, central banks are more independent now, and so they can have technocrats doing what they think is right rather than having politicians catering to short-term temptations. And I suppose, you know, do you want a bunch of academic economists and central and, you know, bankers running the monetary system, or do you want a bunch of politicians? I guess if I had to choose, I guess the former, but they're both pretty bad outcomes. I would rather have neither of them in control of it and instead have a decentralized system. You know, the original, you know, gold standard was like that, in a respect that, you know, nobody controlled the stock of gold. Individual people did. Bitcoin even takes that one level further to decentralize it even more for people who want to set up a mining rig.
And so this is all kind of comes down to Austrian economics. Is that correct?
Yeah. The specific school of thought that I believe in is what's called the Austrian school of economics. And just, you know, going back to the Fed, the Austrian understanding of the business cycle. Why is it that market economies have these booms and then busts? It's not because, oh, yeah, that's just capitalism. The Austrian theory says it's precisely because of the banking system inflating, pushing down interest rates that causes apparent prosperity, but it's not real and it collapses. If you got money and banking out of the hands of centralized state-run institutions or cartels, among other benefits, you would either get rid of the business cycle or dampen it very severely. according to Austrian theory. So since that's the theory I believe in, that's just one of the reasons I think a world that embraced something like Bitcoin would be spared the ravages of the business cycle. For your listeners, I would point people to understandingbitcoin.us is a website I have where my co-author Silas Barton and I have a guide to try to bring in, like, what do you need to know from Austrian economics? What do you need to know from cryptographic, you know, results to understand Bitcoin and why it has the potential to help human flourishing?
Do you have any other websites or social media?
My personal website is consulting by RPM, Robert Patrick Murphy, consultingbyrpm.com.
Great. And I'm just curious, when you were on with John Bush, are you guys good friends? It was just such a kind of a fun conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I met him a lot at Pork Fest and other events. And yeah, he can take a joke and, you know, so we kind of razz each other. Yeah.
Okay. That was quite fun listening to you guys. Well, thanks so much. Right. I'm honored to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I'm meeting Catherine Bleich for the first time.
Right.
That's kind of exciting to me. Obviously, I hear you on Let's Talk Bitcoin. Is everything you and John release go through Let's Talk Bitcoin, or do you have your own outlets that are separate too?
We have outlets everywhere. Basically, we're media production machines. But John's podcast, the Sovereign BTC podcast, most of it goes through Let's Talk Bitcoin. He's doing a challenge with a trading company, and I don't think that's on Let's Talk Bitcoin, but almost everything that John does in terms of audio is on Let's Talk Bitcoin. We also run a top of the hour news service called the Liberty Beat. It airs here locally on 90.1. So if you're driving around Austin, turn on 90.1 and you'll get to hear our news service at the top of the hour.
We're here at your booth and you've got shirts and books. And obviously, just from listening to the podcast, I always hear about it's Brave New Books. Brave New Books, right? I should have remembered that. Is that your business, or you guys just work with them, or?
Well, we are actually in the process of buying the bookstore.
That's really cool. Have you guys, like, been activists your whole life?
Well, John and I think we're both activists in our own right as youth. I was an environmental activist. I did the environmental club in high school as the president and, you know, orchestrated highway pickups and things like that. John was more of a, I'm going to rebel against the school because they have a tardy table policy. And, you know, I think one of his principals or counselors said something about, you know, the FBI watches kids like you. So we've both been activists. We actually met each other at the Continental Congress in 2009. I was a delegate from Missouri. He was a delegate from Texas. And our table, he sat right in front of me and we hit it off. Everyone thought we were already a couple by the end of the event because it was just instant. And basically, we've been doing joint activism ever since we met in 2009. We just really complement each other in so many ways.
Very cool. Very cool. So listening to you and John's show and stuff, it's, you know, listening to you guys coin, what was it? What do you call your coin tour?
Unconventional tour.
Unconventional tour. So listening to all that and stuff. So that was all really fun. And you came through L.A., the dearth of Bitcoin
with
restaurants.
With one restaurant. Oh, man.
I have no idea what the problem is, but I'm embarrassed for our city. I apologize.
Maybe y'all need to do a blitz and go out and hit up a bunch of businesses all in one weekend or something.
It's funny. I've talked to you. You've met Melissa Jim,
yes.
I guess. I mean, we've talked about, we should
her.
Go out and do that. But, you know, everybody's so busy, we never
just
do that.
Just set a date like 3 months out and just tell everyone
this
is what
we're
doing.
Yeah, I guess it's just setting
Commit
the date.
Commit to it.
Yeah. So, where's John today?
John is with the kids at his parents' house. We have to attend a wedding. I got to leave pretty shortly.
Okay.
So, he'll be here tomorrow.
Right. Looking forward to meeting him now, too.
Yeah, it'll be great. You know, for me, it's about the philosophy in my heart, about being a truly free and sovereign being. And, yeah, so discovering that the natural state of being is anarchy is really mind-blowing. And so for me, when I heard about Bitcoin, it was a natural fit. You know, like, I was already there and ready for it. I wish I had learned about it a little sooner for financial reasons.
Sure. When was this you learned about Bitcoin?
The first Bitcoin we accepted was at the Porcupine Freedom Festival in 2012.
Oh, that's pretty good.
I think, or it might have been 11, but it was worth $3 at the time, so you'd have to figure out from there. So we could sell a taco for a Bitcoin.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Can't complain.
No complaints.
I see all these different projects you guys are involved in. Do you guys, like, either of you have like a day job, or is it?
Are 100% freelance. We have a decentralized income. So podcast, news service, working vendor booths, writing, website stuff, and we are in the process of buying brave new books. So by the end of April, we will be fully managing the bookstore, and we will be in the process of paying it off from the old owner. So that's going to be our big project coming soon.
And will there be a chance for people who don't live in Austin? Or is it in Austin proper?
It's in Austin, okay. Yeah. 1904 Guadalupe on MLK in Guadalupe. And I have built the website. It is not live yet. You will be able to shop all of our amazing health products, our conspiracy books, our Bitcoin items, all for Bitcoin. It takes PayPal and other payments, but who cares about those?
Sure. What is the website URL?
Well, right now it's bravenewbookstore.com, and it's the old website. There's no store or anything on it. But if you check back maybe midweek next week, I don't know when you're going to publish
this. After that. So
okay,
by the time
someone
hears this.
Yeah, check now. If it looks like an actual online store, you're in the right place.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking
with
me, Catherine.
Good luck with your podcast.
Thanks a lot. Today's magic word is mega. M-E-G-A. You have 1 week from this episode's release to use the magic word and claim your share of this week's listener distribution of LTB coin on letstalkbitcoin.com. I'm here with Andy Gonzalez, who was actually the first and probably only person who walked up and wanted to interview me, which I don't know if I gave a very good interview. I hope you edit it to make me sound good. Because
I don't have the same setup you do, and because you have it all set up here, and I have a simple mic. But I think we got some good stuff.
Okay, so Andy told me he's about to start his own podcast with maybe hopes of getting it on Let's Talk Bitcoin.
That'd be fantastic. I completed 1 year of law school. I did just fine. But during my studies, I kept turning my head towards the Bitcoin space, and it just kept calling my name. I told my parents, I said, guys, I got to pursue this Bitcoin thing for 1 year. Give me a chance. Give me a shot. The dean said, yeah, do whatever you want. Just come back. I said, okay, great.
And so how long ago was that?
This was 4 months ago.
Are you trying to gather content here to actually launch your podcast?
I definitely have been. This is going to be a great episode. Maybe it's going to be the first episode. And what I've done is I've talked to multiple people in the Bitcoin space. And I was looking for their Genesis story. And I asked you yours, and you did a great job. And everyone has a unique Genesis story. So it's going to be a fun, interesting, and it's going to be an amalgamation of content for the first podcast.
Okay. I don't even feel like I told you my Genesis story. But
oh, okay. Well, give it to me right now.
I don't even know if it's really what it is. I mean, this is my interview.
Sorry.
So what other things are you doing in the Bitcoin space?
Well, it seems like everyone kind of is the same, where we start to pivot from project to project until we can finally execute on one and it takes off. I had an idea for a platform, which I was really excited about. And I was excited about it because I'm also a gamer, and I was a gamer growing up most of my life. And a problem that most gamers have is they can't really monetize, or they can't really profit off of their passion unless they make it big, unless they become a pro and go into those crazy, you know, big lucrative tournaments where they make millions of dollars. But a lot of people do put a lot of time into gaming. So what I was thinking of doing is making a platform, a decentralized platform, where any gamer that feels they're competent enough to teach, they can find a student, and then they can teach the student and be paid in any cryptocurrency. And I thought this was a great idea, and I thought I could make it decentralized. What I didn't know, because I'm not a programmer, is that you can't just throw the word decentralize it at something and make it work. It's not like a magic spell. You're like, you know, I'm hungry, decentralize it, and it'll get fixed. No, there's real world problems that everyone's trying to somehow get decentralization into the mix and fix the problem. But there's always going to be a point of centralization to most projects in one way or another.
So that's one you've passed on now? And
it feels that way. It's still there. You know, if I somehow find a way to revive it, I'll give it a shot.
So you had mentioned that you are trying to be active and basically get merchants to accept Bitcoin. Is that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Big and small. In San Antonio, starting off in San Antonio, we feel starting small, starting with a small local community, it's a better start than trying to just go anywhere and everywhere, trying to hit up any person.
So how's that going?
Well, I keep running into the same issue where they say, So you can bring traffic? Can you bring people that are going to spend Bitcoin? And most times I say, well, sure, but in time. I can't show you numbers right now on a local level. Mm-hmm. On a national level, on a global level, there's a lot of people that use it, but they're not all going to come to San Antonio to this one coffee shop or to this one shop where someone's tailoring clothing. And so that's where I got the idea. I thought, well, if I can make a podcast to educate, because I guess we're looking at it all wrong. We shouldn't just go to a business. We should go to the community. If the community wants it, if they see the value proposition of Bitcoin, they see the merits of Bitcoin, they'll say, well, I want to use it. Then the business will say, well, they want to use it. I want to accept it. So we're trying to tackle it. That's an idea. That's why the podcast is something that I'm starting to do.
Okay. So I was mistakenly, I guess, thinking maybe you are going to make podcasts as you're going out trying to get people. And 'cause that's, I think, would be interesting.
Yeah. That's something I also thought about. Maybe trying to teach them while doing the podcast at the same time and seeing how they're, you know, what their criticisms are against it, or if they see anything valid about it.
So that's a double whammy, I guess, getting them to agree to be on the podcast and getting them to agree to
it. What is the Sui Bitcoin?
Today's sponsor is Bitcoin Keychains by bkeychain.com. You've seen these keychains on dozens and dozens of websites. It's about time you had one of your own. These substantial metal keychains make great conversation starters, and they make great gifts to or from Bitcoiners. You can find a list of retailers at bkeychain.com, several of whom support Bitcoin so much they won't even accept fiat currency. And of course, you'll always get the best deal from these retailers. So what are you waiting for? Go to bkeychain.com.
I'm here with Bradley Rotter from Infinity Algorithms, which I've heard of but really know next to nothing about. I know there's something to do with MadeSafe, so start at the beginning.
Well, I started out as a child. It's wonderful to be at the Texas Bitcoin Conference. I've been at these conferences all over the world now, and it's fun. It's fun to be in Austin and feel the excitement of everyone here. I'm an investor. I've founded a couple of companies in the crypto space. The first is Rivets, which makes tremendous hardware security available to the cryptocurrency world.
Right, and I just interviewed Stephen for my most, I don't know when this will drop, but the podcast that was just out last Friday.
He's the most interesting individual.
It's so amazing talking to people like that and hearing about their background. It's very impressive. Obviously, he's a really smart guy, very accomplished. So.
I consider him the planetary expert on trusted computing. He's been doing it longer than anybody, and It's the only technology that's fundamental to every other technology that's here. It's a requirement to keep this cryptocurrency secure.
I mean to me it's everything we're doing. We need more security. So I hope that's going to help with the current password type logins and stuff.
You know, I've never really viewed this as a currency play. Bitcoin and the other alternative currencies. I view it as a cybersecurity play. And that's my background. I've been doing a lot of work in the cybersecurity realm, and it's fundamental not only to Bitcoin but the survival of our damn country.
Okay, and I do think it's really interesting to hear about background. So, what exactly were you doing in cybersecurity?
I have been in catalyzing and investing in companies that impact the security of the homeland. That's my driver. I've been doing that pretty much since 9/11. This was my way of giving back and giving the country a little more hang time. You know, what's interesting about the war in cybersecurity is this is the first damn war in history that cannot end. There's no one to surrender. There's no flag. There's no capital. There's no general command staff. It's the first war in history that we're all on the battlefield for. The wars used to be over there somewhere. So this is a significant problem. I think it can be won, and I think companies like Rivets are fundamental to winning that battle. But we must win the battle, or our very survival depends on it.
Can you tell me a little bit about Infinity Algorithms?
Yes, happy to. That Infinity Algorithms, in my view, is another cybersecurity play, but a bold new play. I was originally told about the MadeSafe network by a 14-year-old Bitcoin miner who I had befriended. This was a few years back, and he said, Mr. Rotter, you should look at MadeSafe. And I did.
Wow, so that was well before the crowdfunding then, right?
Yes, it was. And I did look at MadeSafe and then was so taken by it, I flew to Troon, Scotland to meet David Irvine and Nick Lambert, who were the guys that have been working on this for many years. MadeSafe is one of the most important developments that I have seen in my technical career. What is MadeSafe? MadeSafe is a distributed, decentralized, peer-to-peer, self-authenticating, self-managed network that just runs on math and logic. It's autonomous. All of the data is encrypted, then sharded into millions of pieces and spread around the world. And the map of where the encrypted shards go is encrypted again. It is better than NSA security, which may not be saying too much. And the entire thing is serverless. I'll repeat the last word, serverless. It's one of my favorite things up there with gravity and infinity algorithms.
Wait, the Earth force gravity, or is there a new thing I don't know about?
Yeah. I've never seen gravity, actually, but I believe in it. I really believe in the MadeSafe network, and as a result, have co-founded a company called Infinity Algorithms, which has some amazing applications that will rest upon the MadeSafe network. And so, our main mission is to bring the efficient market theory to the largest commodity that has ever been and will ever be.
And that is?
Data.
Okay.
And it's going to be a fascinating ride. This is, I'm very, very excited about it. I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about the safe network and what it means for the planet.
Interesting. So I mean, obviously, it was huge. You probably know offhand. How much was the fundraiser? How much funds were raised?
They raised $6 million in 5 hours. It was nobody's ever seen anything like it.
So basically, you really think it's an important project, and you're trying to really build upon it.
Yes, I am. I think it's fundamental.
So what is it you guys are really doing?
We're building the first SafeX exchange, which will be where people will be able to onboard with SafeCoin. We're building a number of fascinating applications that will utilize the Safe network. It's very akin to SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Do you remember that project years back? I personally thought they should have started by searching for intelligence in Washington, but they chose the universe. And I thought that was a very interesting project. In many regards, MadeSafe is kind of akin to that, and using the spare hard disk space that everybody has on their laptops, desktops, or corporate servers, and dedicating that for processing a peer-to-peer network in a highly secure fashion.
All right, thanks for talking to me.
Very nice meeting you.
I'm just was walking by and saw the Oregon Mines booth, and I guess I'm here with Matthew Carson.
Yep, Matthew Carson. I'm the Vice President of Sales for Oregon Mines.
Okay, and I've got to admit, as being someone who's into Bitcoin, the one thing I've kind of stayed away from and least knowledgeable about is mining. So what does your business do?
Basically, we provide complete data center solutions, not just for Bitcoin mining, but also for traditional data center clients. But basically, we have a large facility out in Oregon with a huge amount of very cheap power and cooling, so that we can manage very large farms of Bitcoin miners for clients and or for ourselves.
So there's cheap power, and I guess that's really important for being economical.
Yeah, the cheaper the power you have, the more competitive you can get. Because, realistically speaking, the Bitcoin miners are the same around the world. There's minor differences between manufacturers, but what really affects your bottom line is what your capital expenditures are, not just for the equipment itself, but also the continuation of running it.
Would you be labeled a cloud mining service, or are you a little different than
that? No, we would be labeled a co-location or hosting provider. We don't directly sell any hash rate. We sell either machines that are within a certain hash rate, but that you legally own the machine and can have it sent to you at any time, or we sell the space and power needed if you have your own machines.
What percentage of people send in their own machines versus...
Right now, it's almost it's about 40-60. 60% of the hardware we have right now is client-owned, and they brought and or shipped it to us, and 40% was hardware that we had purchased and that we had sold to the clients already there and running.
What are most of the people doing, do you think?
Well, all of the people who have machines, whether they're mining Bitcoin, we've just recently introduced the rest of the data center options because we just had our first fiber line put in, and we have our secondary going in shortly. So before a couple weeks ago, we did not have sufficient bandwidth, internet bandwidth, to offer traditional data center services. So now we'll be able to do everything from hosting websites to cloud services to even, you know, email servers for small to medium-sized businesses. Anything you would be able to do at a traditional data center.
So are you ever having to be hands-on when there's an issue, or can everything be done remotely?
Especially for the Bitcoin miners, unless there's an actual hardware problem, all of our clients have VPN access to their own machines. So outside of reboots or possible problems with power supplies, it's pretty much completely hands-off.
And if there is a hardware issue, just give you a call? Or?
Yeah, we have 24/7 staff on hand, as well as extra staff in the immediate vicinity if there's a real problem.
Interesting. What was your background before you were doing Oregon Mines?
Well, I've been in the Bitcoin world since 2011 or so, 2010, 2011. Started out, like most people, mining GPUs in their garage. And then once ASICs come along, I saw the business opportunity. It just took us much longer than expected to build our facility. Learned a lot of lessons and a lot of important things for future growth.
So I'm always curious, you don't have to answer any of these questions, but anyone who was mining back then, have you managed to hold on to a significant amount of coins? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I not as much as I originally had, obviously, because the value's gone up so much, but I definitely still have some of my original coins. But I buy some here, I spend some here. I keep a majority of it, but it's important to show support for the economy, especially when it's cheaper and easier. Like I just, for my flight tickets for this conference, I bought a American Airlines gift card off of Gift and got 3% cash back.
Oh, wow, that's great.
It's better than using even their American Airlines credit card.
Well, what brought you to Bitcoin in the first place?
Well, I'm by trade, I'm a business economics major. So it first intrigued me just from a pure economic standpoint, you know, a worldwide, basically decentralized, deflating currency is something that's never been attempted before. So it's interesting to watch the global dynamics and the economics behind it, given our fiat-based debt economy around the world. So that, and, you know, like most people in Bitcoin, I have a little bit of a libertarian streak, so it appeals to my ideas of personal freedom. I like the idea that my money is always under my control. I don't have to worry about even, you know, small things like banks close at 4 o'clock. What if I need to get bank work done after I get out of work? I'm out of luck. With Bitcoin, I can wake up at 3 a.m., log on to my computer, and do all my banking.
So were you also a tech person?
Yeah, I've been doing IT computer-related stuff since I was 14, 15. So this was a natural extension of myself.
Definitely. With the economics and tech, yeah, what a natural fit for Bitcoin that would be. Well, very interesting. Is there anything else you think people should know about Oregon Mines?
Well, one of our biggest things is there's been a lot of concern, although I believe it's quite overblown, about, you know, the environmental impact of Bitcoin mining. And I'm happy to say that 100% of our power is hydroelectric. We use not a single watt of non-renewable energy.
Well, I think that's fantastic for anyone trying to stay green and mine at the same time. It looks like your website is OregonMines.com. Is there any other websites or social media?
Right now, just our website. Usually, there's always a staff member who has insomnia who's answering emails at 4 a.m. So,
okay, well, great. Well, thanks so much for talking to me, Matthew.
You're welcome.
I'm here with Reeve Collins, CEO of Tether. I guess I first heard of your business when it was RealCoin. You know, I've been intrigued. I've heard people say different really useful things for Tether, but kind of explain the whole concept of Tether and what you think it's useful for.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what it's useful for is simply the same thing that dollars are useful for, right? So Tether's is real-world currency, dollars, euros, yen, etc., formatted to work on the blockchain. So now we're enabling dollars to work just like, to transact like Bitcoin.
How is the digital asset backed by U.S. dollars?
In a nutshell, you give me $1,000, we put it in our custodial accounts, we issue you 1,000 Tether. Those Tether tokens are just like Bitcoin tokens, which work on the Bitcoin blockchain. And so we have to ensure that they're secure and that you can trust where they are and that you can trust that you can redeem that token for a dollar at any time. So we put a lot of mechanisms in place to provide that, to provide those assurances, such as transparency. You can see how many tokens are on the blockchain, and you can see how much, how many dollars or how much currency is in our custodial accounts.
And is this all your idea?
The idea evolved. Brock Pierce, Craig Sellers, a handful of people, and the idea evolved over time, especially when Bitcoin's quite volatile. And so one, people were talking about, okay, how do we create an alternative that has all of the features and functionalities but none of the volatility? And kind of the elephant in the room as well, let's use currency, the currencies you're familiar with, and make them work on the blockchain. And so that's how the idea came about.
I've heard people say it might be a really good way to get in and out of other cryptocurrencies. Is it?
Absolutely. So look at crypto-to-crypto exchanges, for instance. Their base trading pair is Bitcoin. And if you're a trader, the challenge is Bitcoin in itself is volatile. So now they can use a local currency, or such as dollars, as the base trading pair. So if they want to get out of Litecoin, they can hold it in Tether and then get into Bitcoin or Dogecoin. So it's great for crypto-to-crypto exchanges. And then just exchanges in general, if you, as a payment method. So now instead of sending a wire utilizing the regular banking system and withdrawing and having wires sent back to you, now you can send money as Bitcoin, so it's much faster, and you can send it from exchange to exchange. So it just gives a lot more portability to the dollar.
So are there all kinds of crazy compliance issues you guys have to worry about?
Yes. So we have to go down the road of becoming licensed and regulated globally in the various jurisdictions. We're working out of Hong Kong right now under a money transmitter license in Hong Kong, working on one in Europe as well as the United States, as well as banking partners in the various different countries.
Would Tether ever be something you think like major banks would use to transfer funds across borders and things like that?
They would either utilize Tether or utilize our platform to issue their own token. So if they want to, let's say it's Bank of America and wants to issue a Bank of America dollar, or stating that now all of our money's backed in Bank of America and they have their own token, they could utilize our platform to do that.
Okay, so you're not like riding on Counterparty or Omni or something like that. You're your own platform.
We're utilizing Omni right now, yes. But we have added our own layer of technology on top of it in order to make it do exactly what we need to do. And so we've really refined that technology to service currencies being issued on the blockchain. And so when other individual company, when other large companies or countries, etc., are interested in doing a currency issuance, they can come to us because we really have the expertise and have built a technology that's really fine-tuned to do that.
And what's the specific technology that's important to be able to do what you're doing?
So number one, like the bulk of what comes from Omni is the ability to issue the asset and redeem the asset. So basically create a token and have it destroyed. But they're basically purchased into existence. You give us $1,000, we create 1,000 Tethers. And when we redeem them, we destroy them. So that's part of it. And then the other layers on top of it are integrations within the ecosystem, all of the reporting, the transparency, the auditing capabilities. Those are the different layers that you add into it.
So I guess auditing is really important.
Auditing is extremely important, right? Because auditing on the blockchain is easy. The part that's difficult is showcasing that our fiat balances are actually there and they are secure. And the traditional way is utilizing a KPMG or some sort of large audit firm, which we do. But what's much more important is that we're utilizing all of the companies within the ecosystem to enable the public to do the audits. So we utilize Factum. We utilize another company called TSL Notary, which allows basically voting and allows people to piggyback into the bank balances so they can actually see it. So it allows the community to, utilizing a bunch of different tools, allows the community to perform the audit, which is very important for us. So you don't have to trust us, you don't have to trust KPMG, but when the community gives it the stamp of approval, and then it's put on Factum so you can go back at any time and see that it was actually there, It's much more important.
Okay, and I've been so many announcements, it seems like, lately with people working with Factum.
Yeah.
Are there worries at all that what if one of your bank accounts carrying the dollars is frozen, or, I mean...
Right, so one, we obviously work with very reputable banks, and all the banks are published, and everyone knows exactly where their money is. Two, we have a federation of banks, like a handful of banks that we work with in various different countries to spread out where the dollars are. But the bottom line is that they are multinational, large banks. They're not going to steal your money. We're banking in very sophisticated regions. This isn't Cyprus where the government's going to come in and take 20%. That's like asking anyone else if what happens if Bank of America seizes your funds, right?
Is Tether something that's you can use now?
Yeah, no, it's live. You can acquire Tether. Our site is still in private beta, but our partners are live. Bitfinex, you can acquire Tether there and withdraw your cash balances via Tether. We have a handful of exchanges that are coming live very soon that we'll be announcing in the next few weeks. Poloniex is a crypto-to-crypto exchange that's live now. And then you can, GoCoin is a payment processor that has thousands of merchants, so you can purchase goods and services via their merchants through GoCoin. And so it's definitely working. It's out there. People are trading it, and we're having more and more integrations come on board soon.
We got Shapeshift over here. Any reason they might not add Tether coins?
No, they are. Yeah,
they are.
Yeah. So we're working with a lot of different of these companies because it's just it enables all the companies in the ecosystem to provide their goods and services not only in just Bitcoin, but in currencies that people are familiar with. You have Tether USD, Tether Euro, and so now individuals can trade in dollars and utilize these new blockchain companies with real-world currencies.
Great, great. So Tether.to.
Yes.
Great. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
I'm meeting John Bush for the first time right now. Morning.
Morning.
I hung out with your wife a little bit and interviewed her yesterday. And
cool.
She told me you guys are taking over Brave New Books.
Yes.
Am I allowed to say that?
I guess so. More people know than I've told, so sure, yes.
Okay. It just happened. How the deal? Or?
Yeah, we should be taking over officially at the beginning of May, end of April.
Wow. So what are your roots to bring you to where you are today?
Yeah, I was a rebel in high school, just naturally, without really a philosophy behind it. And in 2002, I caught a documentary on cable access here in Austin about 9/11 by Alex Jones, of all people, 9/11 Road to Tyranny. And from that point on, I began questioning the official story of what took place on 9/11. And that kind of opened up a Pandora's box and sent me down the rabbit hole to question a lot of what I was taught in school. In college, I learned about the Constitution and the Founding Fathers and began to appreciate their philosophy. Later, I would come to realize that it's totally bogus and they were big hypocrites, and the Constitution actually created less freedom than existed before the Constitution, but I started thinking about those ideas. And then in 2007, I was introduced to Ron Paul through his presidential campaign, and that's how I was introduced to the philosophy of libertarianism. And from Ron Paul, I was introduced to Murray Rothbard, who kind of coined the term anarcho-capitalism and got me thinking more in a consistent philosophical way. And then I met Catherine. She was very similar in her beliefs, and it was her that inspired me to kind of put the philosophy into practice. And, you know, it's one thing to talk about liberty, it's another thing to live liberty. And since 2009, 2010, we've been trying to live our lives in a manner that's consistent with the philosophy of liberty and try to avoid coercive institutions and that which we find unethical. And we're trying to raise our children in a manner that's consistent with those ethics as well. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
So explain to me, on a day-to-day basis, what does that mean to live under the principles of liberty?
Well, we try to limit our use of Federal Reserve notes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we convinced our office landlord to accept Bitcoin, which is cool. We have a little mining operation in the office, so the Bitcoin's mined in the miners, and then we pay rent with it.
Uh-huh.
Although it's not very profitable at the moment.
Sure.
It was profitable for a little while, but not anymore. And, we just try to avoid the use of Federal Reserve notes. When it comes to parenting, we don't coerce our children. We're peaceful parents. We don't spank. We don't do rewards and punishment or timeout. And we try to be as laissez-faire and hands-off as possible. I think it's important, too, to avoid centralized institutions like grocery stores when you can and try to get your own food locally and eat organic as well. So We're also working, so I'm going to be doing a talk here at noon about this concept that we've been working on called the Central Texas Mutual Aid Society, and also this concept of Freedom Cells, which is like a peer-to-peer decentralized mutual aid society. So we're trying to engage in alternative institutions whenever we can, but also we're trying to build alternative means of social organization with small groups getting together and committing themselves to mutual aid and mutual defense. So that'll be something I'll be talking about later.
Okay, and I did hear your podcast about the Freedom Cells, so
yes,
people
yes.
can find that. So when did you get into Bitcoin?
I guess I started hearing about it and being curious about it in 2010, it must have been. And I think it was really the Liberty Forum 2011 at Nashua, New Hampshire. This is where Eric Voorhees and Roger Ver were there and a bunch of the early Bitcoin guys. And this is where Jeffrey Tucker was introduced to Bitcoin. And but then I was just thinking about it, and Catherine actually was begging me to start mining. And I wish that I would have taken her advice there, but we were so busy with all sorts of other stuff. I kept telling her, well, I want to understand it more before we get into it. Maybe we would have been Bitcoin millionaires if we would have at that time. Maybe not. Maybe we would have sold it all when it got to 100 or something. But yeah, so that's when I was just curious learning about it. And then when I really began to understand it, it kind of just picked up. And in 2013, at the end of 2012, Catherine and I kind of committed ourselves to spending a good amount of time and energy with Bitcoin and trying to make a career, include it in our careers. And here we are today.
So I already kind of forgot the timing. Were you trying to avoid Federal Reserve notes before you got into Bitcoin then? Were you like using silver and stuff? Or?
Yes. Yeah, Catherine and I were big fans of junk silver, and we would actually go around Austin encouraging businesses to accept silver in exchange for goods or services. We would accept silver in exchange for goods or services that we offered. So we were already into alternative currencies, so when we heard about Bitcoin, it was a natural fit. And since then, I've kind of abandoned silver. I'm not as excited about it because I'm way into cryptocurrency and all that it offers. It transcends silver. It's such a better vehicle for transfer of value than silver.
Yeah, I imagine.
That's not to say silver's no good. Silver's definitely preferable to FRNs. Anything is, really, maybe even conch shells. But
well, I'll tell you, it's been inspiring just to see all you do and listen to your podcast, and I'll have to check out more of what you guys are doing. But you guys have your hands in so many things. It's really interesting. And
we're stretched a little thin, and we have two toddlers, so we try to keep balance. Balance is the goal, really.
Well, it must be tough. You must be stressed at times. You don't sound stressed, but you must be stressed at times.
I've been studying and trying to practice Buddhism, so I like to let go of things, and everything is what it is. There's no need to stress or worry about it. Just take a deep breath and keep calm and carry Bitcoin.
All right. Well, it's been great talking to you. Maybe we'll talk again with John just to have us all three together.
Yeah.
And I'll see you throughout the day.
Right on. Thanks.
You guys are Miner Edge?
That's correct.
All right, and what's your name?
I'm Nathan, the founder and CEO.
It looks like you guys build mining equipment?
That's correct.
I see a bunch of cars here. What exactly are you building here?
So we're building probably the first upgradable modular Bitcoin mining system. You don't have to throw anything away other than the hashing module when it's time to upgrade.
Which part is the hashing module?
These four modules across the front here are the mining modules. This is the management card. We've separated it from the rest of the system for ease of upgrade.
How have other people been building things that makes this different?
Well, when the miner is used up and done, people throw the whole thing away, sometimes including the power supply, chassis, heat sink, management card, and everything goes away.
So I assume you guys buy ASICs from someone? And
Spondulis, yes. We're using 32 of their Rockerbox ASICs in this system.
So this system here, like, what would the hash rate be on this?
Up to 6 terahash. You could go faster, but efficiency tends to go down. You're just beyond the limit of what the ASIC can do. And so we don't suspect too many people will go much beyond 6 terahash.
You sell complete self-contained units, but just have the upgradable modules. Is that right?
Well, this is water-cooled. That's the other thing that's different about ours. It's open-loop, meaning you could plumb this into any other infrastructure. It uses standard industrial cooling pressures. So It's nothing that any industry in the world wouldn't be able to accommodate. But it does mean that you have the ability to use the waste heat for something productive. Unlike every other miner on the planet today, you're just venting the heat into the air and wasting it.
Would a miner be at all efficient if you wanted to use it as a water heater? I mean,
you could, but you know, your water heater gets hot and then it stays hot. It's designed to not have to continually need extra heat, so might not be the best application for this. I would say if you lived up north and you had like radiant floor heating, that would be a more home-related application for this, because you're going to need to heat your floors all winter long, and you could plumb this into there.
Do you have any idea how the heating efficiency, say you were just getting an efficient floor heater, which I know nothing about being from Southern California, but versus a mining unit?
About 90% of all the energy that goes in this box will go out as heat in the water. You know, you're at least getting Bitcoin from your heat, whereas before you get nothing other than heat.
So it really does make sense, I guess, if you needed heat and wanted to mine bitcoins, and who wouldn't want to get some bitcoins while they're heating? That makes sense, you're saying.
Yeah, basically. You can. I mean, in some parts of the world, we're in the U.S. here, so natural gas is abundant, and so most people heat their homes with natural gas or some sort of petroleum-based stuff. So it's relatively low cost. Other parts of the world, it's very difficult to get natural gas, so they're either having to truck in oil for heating, or they burn electricity. So some parts of the world may have very low-cost electricity. Therefore, mining is very popular there. And if that's what they're using for their form of heat, this is an ideal application for that.
I guess if you're going to have this in a data center, you don't get to benefit from that heat.
Well, it depends on where your data center is. And that's the great thing about water. If you were dumping this heat into air, you can't reasonably move that hot air anywhere other than directly outside. With water, you could plumb hot water miles. And in some facilities do that. They have a centralized heating and chilling center, and they'll heat a whole campus with water.
Wow, that's really cool. Is there anything for people who would know more than me that you want to add just to talk about what you're producing?
From the technical side, I would say that we've invested probably the most energy into, well, energy, or the efficient conversion of energy. So our voltage regulators are some of the most efficient in the industry. You know, from a layman's perspective here, you can see that these are inductors here, and this is the chip. This is where the energy is generated for the ASIC. It's a clean path. There's no componentry in this way. If you look at anybody else in the industry, they have capacitors there. They've got objects that energy has to flow around, which makes it inefficient.
Very good. So where can people find out more about MinerEdge?
We have a website, MinerEdge.com, and of course the Bitcoin Talk Forum. So we've got a thread going there with a lot of people chiming in already.
Okay, great. And when did you start MinerEdge?
I started it about a year ago. I left Dell to start this company.
And I love just hearing all the amazing things, you know, backgrounds people have before they jumped into Bitcoin. What were you doing at Dell?
Server development, as most of my team has been part of the server development world for many years.
Okay, so obviously you know what you're doing.
I hope so.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
I'm here with Jeff Lee from Hope Gold Coin, and I've got to admit, you guys seem to be a major sponsor of this event, but I know absolutely nothing about what you do, so fill me in.
Well, thanks, Rob. Basically, the purpose behind the Hope Gold Coin is that we want to develop an opportunity to be able to help charities worldwide, and the idea was to build a platform on cryptocurrency to be able to generate revenues to support charity. So Hope Gold Coin, what we've done is we've develop a relationship with Comstock Mining. They're one of the largest, I guess, mining consortiums here in the United States. And what they've agreed to do is they're putting up 100 tons of gold, of in-ground gold reserves, against 1 billion Hope Gold coins. And basically what we do is when we sell the coins to the general public, you know, will say they buy a coin for $10. That $10 comes into the charitable trust. That money's taken, given to our trust account, and then that money's taken and disseminated back into charities that meet what we consider the HOPE vision, which is basically providing health, opportunity, purpose, and education to those, you know, less fortunate throughout the world. And so the individual that's, you know, purchased the coin, they still maintain a $10 coin that they can use for goods and services as they want to, but their $10 has actually gone to help support a charity. So in theory, you can give the charities and it really doesn't cost you anything to do so.
Wow, so my head is spinning. This is so, I've never heard of anything like this. Okay, yeah. So in-ground gold, so I'm just curious, is this something just a donation like that this mining company is?
No. Basically, there's a small percentage of the money that comes in, pays the gold mining companies. In other words, they've got, you know, thousands of acres of reserve, you know, proven, tested reserves, so they know how much gold's in the ground. So basically what we do is a portion of the money that comes in to buy the coin goes to the gold mining company for the gold that they're putting up in reserve. And then the rest of the money, what comes into the trust, that's what we can use to disseminate it out to charity. But it's a very small percentage, you know, of the money that comes in that's actually going towards the contractual relationship that we have with the gold mining company.
So that's basically what backs up the coin, where it's not just, you know, some other random kind of
coin. If you think about it like this, you know, let's go back and think about the gold reserves in the federal treasury a number of years ago. They had X amount of gold back against X amount of fiat currency. It wasn't like you could walk in with a dollar and say, give me a piece of gold off of there. But the idea is that at each gold certificate, or, you know, worth $10, is backed by 1/10 of a gram of gold. And the idea is to try to create a more stable currency than we see in bitcoins today. We're basically producing a currency that they're buying from us for $10. And, you know, so it's not like you're going to take it and put it on exchange for 12, because we're continually selling them, you know, for charitable purposes for 10. So hopefully we can create a more stable currency that could be used as a commodity that people could use as a merchant account, where they wouldn't have the fluctuation and high volatility that we see in bitcoins. And, you know, even if, you know, if over the next 10 or 20 years or whatever, and gold went up to, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 an ounce, and hypothetically the coins went from $10 to $20, it's not the same thing as having a Bitcoin that needs to move from $200 to $200,000 to really support the economy of what it would be in the future.
So if the exchange rate does go up and gold becomes more valuable, do you actually sell these coins for more?
Well, I mean, that would be based on the trust committee and how they would handle it. Because the idea is that whatever money that we get that comes into it, it just allows us more money to do more charitable work. But, you know, to speculate on what would or wouldn't, I'm just trying to give you a scenario, not that it would ever even take place, but if somebody wanted to ask the question in a scenario of something like that, you know, maybe you could possibly see it double, whether that would ever happen or not. But the intent is to maintain something where it's continually going out there at a $10 price. So as the market expands, whether you buy it this year, next year, 2 years from now, you didn't come in and have to pay 10,000 times what somebody else, you know, paid for their currency 4 years earlier.
This would not be a coin people would be speculating with then?
No, this is, I mean, if somebody's looking to go buy something for an economic, you know, I want to get rich on buying and playing in the currency market, that's not what this is all about. This is an opportunity to be able to allow existing charities that are trying to reach the help the needy in the world today, to give them a tool that they can use as an opportunity to help those that are in need elsewhere. I mean, I work with a number of charities, but I mean, imagine having a disaster in the Philippines tomorrow. How do you even get financial, you know, how do you get currency even to them in a monetary system that we have today? And then plus the regulations of trying to go through the banking system and the cost of doing the transaction. This affords such an ease to be able to move, you know, finances from one place to another to help charitable needs, no matter where it's needed throughout the world.
So if I were to buy a HOPE Gold coin, do I have some ability to say which one of the charities you work with it goes with?
Well, first of all, if you buy the coin, you have a coin, the money that comes into our organization, we would determine who that money would go to. If you wanted to be charity-minded, you have given our organization $10. Hypothetically, let's just say the whole $10 is going out to charity. You still have a $10 coin. You could give that to any charity that you chose. So technically, your $10 has created $20 worth of charitable work.
Okay, so at this moment, could I buy a HOPE Gold coin?
Yes, you can. Yeah, you can go on the site and you can buy a HOPE Gold coin. The process is a little bit different right now than it will be very, very shortly. It'll be much more automated, but you can go on today and buy a HOPE Gold coin.
Well, very interesting. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, I really appreciate it, Rob. Thank you so much.
You're a man and you want the ultimate shave. Lift 5 razor, it will blow your beard away. Lift 5.
I'm here with AC, who just delivered a speech here at the Texas Bitcoin Conference. What was your speech about?
It was about my business and what I want to do with my Bitcoin when I save it. Like, I wanted to buy a computer, I said, an Alienware one from Dell with Bitcoin. I bought an Xbox Live account, too.
What is your business?
It's Bitmugs, and I sell Bitcoin coffee mugs with the Bitcoin logo on them.
And was that your own idea?
Well, it's me and my dad's.
Oh, very nice. And how long have you been selling Bitcoin mugs?
I don't know. I'll say a year.
Oh, a year. Okay. What are your thoughts about Bitcoin?
Well, I like it because, one, my dad likes it, and I like a lot of stuff that my dad likes. Like, he likes certain movies. I like to search his movies that he watches. And also that it's no one controls it.
Mm-hmm.
Like my dad likes it, too. Yeah.
So I heard you have a Bitcoin paper wallet.
Yeah.
Is that where all your money goes?
Well, not all of it, but a lot of it.
Uh-huh. And is it kept somewhere real safe?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, you don't have to tell me where. Let's keep that secret so no one will try to steal it.
Okay.
So how old are you?
8.
Do you already have an idea what you want to do when you grow up?
I want to be a few things. I want to be an engineer. I want to still be a businessman. And also, I want to, like, invent another cool thing like a robot.
Wow, that sounds really cool.
Because I already have this Lego robot set. It's called Mindstorms.
Uh-huh.
I got it for Christmas. I was lucky for that because it's very, very expensive.
Yeah, I've looked at the prices of those things, but I think they're great for learning. Yeah. So I think it's... You're probably well on your way to doing everything you want to do. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me, AC.
Well, thank you for inviting me to
Sure, and I can't wait to watch over the next few years. I bet you'll speak at some more conferences. And boy, I can't imagine what you'll be doing when you're 12, maybe. All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm here with Dmitry, and you go ahead and tell me your full name.
Dmitry Moraschik, and I'm online as under nickname Rasa.
And you are practically my favorite person here because you came up to me and made me feel special, asking me, I think, are you Rob from the Bitcoin game or something like that, right?
Yeah, I saw that on the back of your t-shirt, and I was like, oh, hey, there's another guy I know.
Tell me what you do for Mycelium.
Technically, my title is community manager, so my job is... keep in touch with the community, find out what kind of things that our customers want, and give our developers basically a list of priorities and what they should focus on. And then when they create updates and add new features, I let the community know what stuff is out there. But besides that, I do stuff like write the documents, write instructions, write announcements for anything to happen, and write, I guess lately, write apologies for how we sent our entropies out and they were kind of packaged a little bad, which created a big concern within the Bitcoin community where customs would open devices and people are thinking that there's some nefarious stuff going on.
Entropies? Now, when I hear entropy, I just think of random number generator or something.
That's what it is. It's okay. A little USB device that you plug into your printer. The device creates, gets a lot of randomness from the device itself. It converts it into a public and private key combination and puts them together into a JPEG of a paper wallet. So if you want to print a paper wallet securely that has never been exposed to the internet, you plug this device into your printer, your printer detects it as a photo, you print a photo, and you're done.
Oh, okay. So this is what you were talking about yesterday, and I was not following. I thought it was a different product.
Because we actually use a real source of entropy to create this instead of some algorithms for randomness.
And what is the source?
Static RAM. Static RAM, when it powers up, it gets covered with a whole lot of noise. Normally, you're supposed to clear it out before you use it for RAM purposes, but we just read the noise directly. And there was a paper published on this that proved that it's a pretty good source of entropy.
So there was an issue with them, or just something that scared people?
More the scared people. We put little holographic stickers on the boxes, but the boxes were kind of soft, and the customs would open up the boxes to check for it. But probably the slightly the more funny issue that came out that I didn't know about it until it blew up was that for all our North and South American customers, all the devices were sent first to my house, and then I was the one who packaged them and shipped them out to Canada, the U.S., and everywhere else. But people didn't know about that, and my house is 15 minutes north of NSA headquarters. So for a while, there's a big kind of conspiracy going on, like, why are devices being shipped from Austria to Canada via NSA headquarter location?
I guess I would wonder, too, about anything. Do you have these units with you?
Not with me. We kind of sold out. I'm sorry.
Darn it. And how much were they selling for?
$40.
And are you going to be selling more?
Most likely, yes.
Most likely. What would stop that?
What happened was we ordered an initial batch of 5,000, but because of delays, we had to rush the first 1,000 devices through. All of those were sold out. The second, the remaining 4,000 batch, we have everything for them except for the money to pay the factory to manufacture them and the CPUs to actually put on the devices. So we just need to put together the remaining $18,000, send that to them, and then I'll start manufacturing them.
Okay. Do you guys need to charge more for them or something?
No.
No, okay.
No. It's just the internal logistics of, like, where do we... Okay, who of our developers is going to front the money to invest in this?
Well, it sounds like a cool product. I'm curious, how do you guys feel confident that your manufacturer is living up to the standards they're supposed to be and the chips and everything?
It's kind of silly, but one of the things that we make sure that is kind of keeps it safe is we use the most cheapest generic components available. So if somebody tries to come up with something a little more advanced to backdoor it, it'll actually make the devices considerably more expensive to manufacture. Also, the manufacturers, they don't know what they're making. We gave them schematics. They put together this thing, fairly simple thing on the boards, and it was actually kind of a problem because we came up with testing software for the devices, and they couldn't figure out what the testing software did or what it's supposed to do. So that's another part of the reason we got delayed a little bit.
So what was your background before you got involved with Mycelium?
Originally, I was a software developer a long time ago. I used to work for McDonald's Corp as their IT manager. Then the whole dot-com bubble went bust, and I saw a lot of jobs being outsourced, so I kind of made a wrong assumption that most IT will go overseas, so it's probably better to switch to something else. Apparently, you can still make a ton of money in IT, but I ended up switching to finance. So before Mycelium, I was a senior financial analyst for, I guess it'd be a mortgage bank of sorts.
So, okay, you're not the first person with both the tech and financial background who made it to Bitcoin, which makes so much sense. So obviously, you saw some value in Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah. Before Bitcoin, I used to play around with online currencies and various games and involving like investing it, trading it, trying to make money off of that. So Bitcoin, to me, was essentially what I was doing before without a third party kind of being in charge of the game.
Very cool. Is there either websites or social media accounts you'd like to tell people about?
Sure. Our website is mycelium.com. We have a place where we post our news, kind of press releases on there. I also post on Reddit under the /rBitcoin under my usernames Rasa, that's RASSAH, and our Twitter account is at myceliumcom.
Okay, it's RASSAH.
Yes.
Just wanted to make sure that was clear. Okay, great. Well, thanks for talking to me, and again, thanks for making my day yesterday by recognizing me.
I look forward to listening to you on my way home.
Okay, thanks so much. I'm here with Eric Voorhees, and I will admit I felt a little starstruck to know you were here. I don't know how it feels to hear that, but I guess when I got into Bitcoin in early 2013, you seemed like you were one of the handful of like the people who, you know, been involved in Bitcoin for a while and were doing a lot. And so I'd used Coinapult a little bit. And are you still involved in Coinapult in any way?
I'm still a partial co-owner. I left about a year ago. So I haven't been involved in the operations since then, but I'm still, you know, I'm still good friends with the guys that are running it.
What was it like living and operating a business in Panama?
So from a business perspective, Panama is excellent. They have much more reasonable financial regulations, and basically if you aren't even serving Panamanian customers, most of the regulations down there don't apply to you whatsoever, which is great. It also has no taxes, no income tax, so you know, you get to keep the money that you actually are earning. You know, it's hard because it is a Spanish-speaking country and it does not have a big tech sector. It was not easy to find tech talent down there, which is something we didn't appreciate before we were already there. So that was probably the biggest challenge.
Are there advantages to operating in a place that I guess there's a lot of financial...
Well, just being outside of the U.S. is nice because Coinapult blocked U.S. customers entirely. And because it was situated and domiciled outside of the U.S., it really was no concern of the U.S. government what it was doing. So that was there's a certain freeing nature about that that allowed us to, you know, build and develop without having to pay ridiculous amounts of money for lawyers telling us everything we're doing is going to get us in trouble.
I saw a lot about Shapeshift. I'm on the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network, and there were ads for Shapeshift. And, you know, when I went on the website and was just amazed at how really unbelievably easy it was to be able to send any cryptocurrency you support to an address and get any other cryptocurrency you support sent to a different address. And I was just like, wow, very neat.
Yep. Super simple.
And then came the announcement that you were behind it.
Yeah.
And that was just like, wow, that's super cool. And so I interviewed some of your team the night of the kickoff party. But I'll just ask you directly, how does Shapeshift work? I mean, behind the scenes.
Yeah. It's quite simple. The way to think about it is like a vending machine. The vending machine has a certain inventory of all the things there. And if you walk up to a vending machine, you don't have to create an account or anything. You just put in some coins and you get your candy bar out, right? So Shapeshift is the same. We hold an inventory of each coin that's supported on the site. And when you come to us with a certain coin that you have, you send that to us and we send you the coin that you want. So it's more like it's more like a store, really, than an exchange where you just walk in and buy something that you want. So it's really that simple. And our exchange rates update, you know, in real time based on what the price of these coins are elsewhere in the market. And we built it to be really fast and simple, but we realized it was actually a far safer model because we don't have to hold customer money. So that means if we got hacked, customer money is not at risk. This is good for both us because it limits our risk. It's also obviously good for the customers because they don't really need to trust us very much at all.
It lowers your risk of other people's funds, but I guess you guys could always get hacked with your wallet somehow.
We could get hacked and lose some of our own money.
Right.
But the way we operate, our hot wallets don't have to be very big at all. So we could get hacked, you know, multiple times and keep on rolling.
How come your hot wallets don't have to be very big?
We have order size limits on the site, so you can't do, you know, like a 20 Bitcoin exchange. We just don't allow it. So because of that, we only have to keep a certain amount of inventory, you know, not hundreds of thousands of dollars or anything.
Does it ever happen that enough people are using your service that you start to get low in your hot wallet?
Yeah, we have to be rebalancing stuff all day long. So part of keeping hot wallets low is that they require a lot of rebalancing. So that's, you know, operationally, we're constantly moving money around in our wallets to keep things in balance. And you can see the deposit limits on the website change in real time to reflect what our balances can support.
Ah, okay. That's it. Very interesting. So are you seeing a lot of growth in use?
Yeah, we've been growing at least an average of 30% per month over the last 6 months. So it's been really fun to see something that I thought would be a good idea actually get put into the marketplace and for people to be finding it useful. Most of the people that try it out are just like, wow, this was obvious. This is how currency exchange should work.
Does this kind of a model somehow help you deal with any kind of anti-money laundering laws and stuff like that? Or?
Well, we do a few things that limit our risk. You know, nothing in the Bitcoin world is risk-free, but we limit our risk largely by not touching fiat whatsoever, and we never will. So we don't have to interface with the banking system at all. We don't ever want to touch fiat. But also, we are not a custodian of funds. So this is an important legal concept. When you hold customer money, lots of the regulations start applying to you. We do not hold customer money, so it removes that whole element of risk from us.
And I guess just about everybody else is holding customer money.
Yeah, I mean, any other exchange is holding customer money. So it's not only financially risky to do that, but it puts regulatory burden on you as well.
When did you first have the idea for Shapeshift?
It was about a year ago, maybe a month after I stepped down from Coinapult, and I was basically trying to buy some kind of altcoin. I don't even remember what it was, but it was going to take me a couple hours to sign up with an exchange, give them personal information, deposit money, wait for confirmations, put in a bid order, wait for that to fill, then withdraw the money and wait for them to approve the withdrawal. You know, it's going to be like a couple hours, and there's no reason that a currency exchange should take a couple hours. So I was like, why is it like this? And it was from that problem that Shapeshift was born.
And I was talking to the guys at Tether, and they say they're probably going to be working with Shapeshift too soon. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean, we add every popular coin to the platform.
So does the fact that Tether is tied to a U.S. dollar value make it somehow more like a dollar? Is it still just a cryptocurrency? And
It's absolutely a cryptocurrency. The fact that there's a private company called Tether that will take that cryptocurrency and give you exactly $1 for it is why it's useful. It doesn't mean that the cryptocurrency itself is dollars.
It seems like it's kind of some legal financial jujitsu to kind of work your way through all the weird compliance laws and stuff.
The market finds a way. Let's just put it that way.
I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great. And I'm excited to watch Shapeshift grow and see what you come up with next.
Yeah.
Well, let me just ask you, do you have another idea in your mind that we're going to see soon?
I'm sure I will, but I'll focus on this one for as long as it needs me.
Great. Well, pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I was just so flattered that you came up to me and said you listened to my podcast, but you said you're involved in some way with the MadeSafe project.
Yeah, the MadeSafe, we're calling it, you know, generally the SAFE network now, because MadeSafe is the company, the guys that are putting it together, and the SAFE, MadeSafe is also separately the foundation, which will contribute to seeing it forward in the future. But overall, it's Project SAFE, and the network itself will be the SAFE. That's all capitals, by the way, because it stands for Secure Access for Everyone.
Great.
So it's a SAFE network.
What kind of stuff do you do helping with the SAFE network?
Well, I'm mainly an enthusiast, and I've been very active on the forum, the SAFE network forum, for over the past year. It's extremely dynamic and a lot of fun.
Is there a separate forum just for the SAFE network?
It's actually a member-supported forum. The community. It was set up not by the company, and it's run by members. And of course, it's frequented by David Irvine, the founder, and Nick Lambert, the COO and of the company, and also the developers. Everybody's involved. And people like me who are on the periphery and not necessarily technically into it, but see the potential of what's going on. And it's such an intricate, I won't say complex, though you could, it's a very intricate endeavor. But, and so it's difficult sometimes to explain.
Yeah, I'd imagine. It does seem fairly complicated. So, how did you first get involved, I guess, probably in...
Well, I was at the Texas Bitcoin Conference last year, and actually, after the fact, I found out about the network after that. I wish I'd been there to actually meet David and Nick in person then. But I heard, it was an interview by Ernest Hancock on Freedom's Phoenix that started opening my eyes, and then Brian Sovereign interviewed David Irvine. And those two things set me going, and then I connected up and got involved, and did a little, moderate purchase of MadeSafe coin on
the
crowd sale, and that's sitting there waiting to go into actual SafeCoin when the network launches. Right now in the world, we have, especially in the West, but even in other places in the world, we've got an awful lot of computers sitting on people's desks, running very often 24 hours a day, with gigabytes of extra hard drive space, CPU just sitting there, and internet connections around the clock. What are we going to do? What if we just found a way to securely connect all of those resources together And that's the genius behind the thinking that David Irvine put into creating the whole concept behind Safe Network. Keep in mind that he's been working on this for over 9 years. He took friends and family started shoving money at him 9 years ago saying, you got to make this happen.
Yeah, I remember being impressed. I guess I probably first heard about it on Let's Talk Bitcoin, and that it was such a project that wasn't just some new thing that came around with the advent of Bitcoin and blockchain technology, that it was something he was somehow envisioning so long ago.
It predates Bitcoin in terms of its conception, and it's been being worked on fairly consistently. The crowd sale last year gave it a real boost in terms of onboarding additional resources of engineers and now we've got a lot of people working around the world. They're trying to foster what they called safe pods around the world. There's one forming in Toronto and San Francisco and a few other places in the world. Ultimately, the idea is once the network is launched, that MadeSafe, the company, will just become one, albeit the most advantaged because of their knowledge, but with the full intent to empower all the other, at least seven other pods around the world with people who know all about it, who can contribute to code, and further evolution of applications and so forth. The nutshell of all of this intricate brilliance comes together in being able to communicate with anyone in the world securely and privately and anonymously or not, as you choose, by default. Websites, they're not subject to takedown. You store information on the network, and it's there forever, unless you delete access to it. It can be either public or private, or private share. You can put things there that only can be shared by people who you give the keys to them. Nothing ever leaves the computer that you're logging on to go onto the Safe Network that isn't completely encrypted in little bits and pieces, that even if somebody could isolate the little bit and piece and decrypt it, wouldn't mean much. Of course, the next question is people ask, well, when? Where is it? It was supposed to be launched last year.
When? That was a question.
Because of course it is. It's mine too. It's always. I was hoping for it to be launched by the end of 2014, as long with everyone else. A lot has happened, and though it's not there yet, a remarkable amount of evolution has occurred. And we've gotten through Testnet 1 and Testnet 2, I believe, is done. If not, it's in final wrap-up. And we're getting to launch the third Testnet from everything I've seen within the next couple of weeks.
Well, thanks so much, John.
Hey,
it's good to meet you.
Really a pleasure.
Where do you live?
I live out in the hill country, not too far from San Antonio.
Well, I'm going to be flying out of here in a few hours, so...
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I'll continue to enjoy your podcast.
Thanks so much. I hope I can continue to deliver content you find interesting.
So far, so good.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Bye.
All right, bye.
If you hear my voice, that means you survived the mega interview episode of The Bitcoin Game. Please let me know you listened by following or tweeting to the BTC Game on Twitter, or by commenting on this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. You can find a listing of all episodes of the Bitcoin Game by going to thebitcoingame.com. See you next time.
John, are you leaving?
Guys, I was just going to find out what you guys are doing.
Oh, we're just talking to each other with mics.
Oh, cool. You guys, if you just put them down, you can just...
Hey.
No, I was just trying to figure out what, like, everybody's doing. Anybody going anywhere afterwards?
I have no idea. I almost feel like just going back to the hotel and going to sleep.
Man. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm exhausted.
I'm tired, too.
He's exhausted, too.
Yeah,
it's
weird.
Just talking to people.
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Oh, Dale.
Hey, Dale.
Rob?
How far are you guys from this venue?
About 20 minutes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Cool. He's thinking about heading back. I'm just not sure what to do.
I didn't know if they were having it.